wonder, Tom, I'm going to kind of bring this all together and talk about living your new success story. So just as a very brief recap, the brain is a very efficient machine. It does not waste energy. Simplicity is just to take the path of least resistance to use neurons already familiar with the task. So the brain inclines toward repeating the old story. And this is how neural pathways, as we know now, are laid down in the brain by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous routes. So, when the client is resistant or frustrated, don't take it personally. They're frustrated too. And this, they're in this groove automatically. They're in a groove, together you can create a path. To think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information or new context. Or, as we heard and Aaron presented, a stimulation of questions in a different way that somebody hasn't considered before. Let's look at decision clarification. This is something I think can benefit from talking about. Let me give you a study that kind of puts us in the ballpark here. A couple of researchers, Steve Ruth Butterfield and Bill Rager, both at West Virginia University, devised a study that ran ads to demonstrate what they were talking about. They made it visually apparent, indicating one glass of whole milk has the same amount of saturated fat as five strips of bacon. At a press conference, they showed reporters a tube full of fat, the equivalent of the amount of a half gallon of whole milk. By making healthy choices specific and tangible, the market share of low-fat milk moved from 18 to 41%. They moved eating healthily from an admirable goal to a specific choice and behavior, a decision clarification. So, when we want to affect change, we need to help script specific behaviors. When you want to affect change in others, help them specifically script that. And this means at times to limit and specify clear options because change has to begin at the level of individual decision and specific behavior. So here are some leading reasons that people resist change. To just review this from a slightly different perspective now, and how understanding these reasons is an initial step for the mentor coach. One is ambiguity aversion. The risk of change is seen as greater than the risk of standing still. You know, kind of like better the devil you know than one you don't. People prefer a known risk to an unknown risk, even if the known risk is high. To make a change requires a leap of faith to move in the direction of the unknown and the unexperienced, and you have no proof. So someone needs to know that you know that, and that you're joining them in this new endeavor, and joining them empathically, and appreciate their uncertainty. People feel connected to other people identified with the present situation, so change threatens losing those identified with the present. This resonates with emotional bonds of loyalty, as well as individual status quo and group inertia. So this is a perspective useful to appreciate at times. Additionally, there may be no new role models for the new activity, or at least mentors who have been there before. To surpass those who have been both mentors and colleagues is challenging. You can't know that you have the competence for a new situation that you've never been in before. This may be a subtle but yet a still pervasive fear that people are concerned that they won't be able to make the transition as well. And the proposed change threatens not only someone's notion of himself or herself, but also how they're perceived by others and whether others will respond with support or with a kind of competitive jealousy. So, narrow the choices. Shrink the change. Specify the next step. Decide what good enough is. And narrow a choice to fit that goal. Now, the caveat here is always consider whether the proposed change is a good idea or a bad idea. Sometimes focusing on the dynamics of the change and the transition process can preclude clear judgment about whether it's really a good idea that needs to be fully engaged. And especially those who automatically see change as a challenge to be engaged may not consider this notion. Or someone who idealizes change rather than examining whether it's a good idea or not. So let's look specifically now at change and transition. This is something we're dealing with all the time. So I think it's useful to have a notion of this, especially as someone moves in a direction of more and more success. The change is the event, the situation. You change behavior, you move to a new city, have a baby, take a new job. As we focus on change, we address the rituals of change, the work tools, the SMART goals. The transition is the process. It's the internal story of change. It's a shift in orientation, even in self-definition, and hence the P in the roadmap about program new changes, a shift of identity. Transition is attention to the seasonal cycles as well as the daily weather. We help clients create change and embrace transition to let go of the old story, the outlived chapter, and evolve into the new story and evolve their working model, their identity along with that to make it permanent. So there are at least four components of transition that I think are helpful to recognize. Not that you're going to see a big bold sign that says this is what it is and you can point it out to the client, but just to have in mind as organizing ideas. One, every transition begins with an ending. Willingly or unwillingly, an ending. It involves letting go of familiar, habitual routines to establish new patterns. So, never underestimate the need and the power of letting go. To move to a new position, you have to relinquish a past one. To do things a new way, you have to end the way you do them now. To become something new, you have to give up some of the old self. To transition to a new possibility, you have to let go of something familiar. Second component of transition. People in transition will create new ways to return to the old story. We talked a lot about the mind and brain reasons for change, how that's difficult, and how to facilitate that change. Every ending is followed by some distress or confusion, and a natural desire to end that confusion by going back to the old story. This is a crucial juncture in coaching. We help a client conceptualize this as an expectable part of change and transition, not evidence that the new choice is wrong or that this is evidence of my intuition is telling me this is not the right thing. Ending, confusion, new beginning. People will resist both the change and the transition. They will return to the familiar or attempt to. We can reframe this return to the familiar with a client as a way of measuring progress, of validating moving ahead, as evidence of proceeding in new territory, and as a way to make sure that we both believe. Three, the new beginning involves changing how you see yourself, even aspects of your identity. The impact and meaning of the transition may bear little resemblance to the apparent significance of the change that precipitated it. Sometimes, something that precipitates a change just simply gets the ball rolling and isn't all the cause and effect that we attribute it, but is something that just is a catalyst for change, a process that had been going on already that makes it in full evidence. You know, one example. Someone can take the loss of a parent in stride, and then when they lose their dog, they fall apart, you know, as if they're kind of one tragedy behind. So I think it's important to recognize the whole flow and the whole process as well as how someone experienced it. Four, never underestimate the change back pressure from the system, your family, your company. It's their self-statement of reaction to change. An attempt to restore normal order and not do the work of change. It doesn't mean they're out to get you. It means that collectively, their minds and brains work to maintain the status quo just as yours does. It's just at different times. You change, they'll react to it. You said the most important problems can't be solved. They have to be outgrown. Now, let's look at, and stop me at any time, or add something, or ask questions. Let's look at pre-commitment. We talk about commitment, but I want to go a step before that to look at pre-commitment. In the Odyssey, Odysseus and his men were sailing home from the Trojan War. He had been warned about the sirens, whose seductive song leads sailors to destruction, but he wanted to hear it anyway. So he does two things. He gives his men earplugs and gives them orders that they tie him to the mast and ignore all subsequent pleas for release until they're safely past danger. This management of desire invents pre-commitment to inoculate himself against his predictable and potentially fatal future desire. Willpower alone may not have been sufficient, and Odysseus knew that no one is immune to temptation. Pre-commitment can be especially useful when it comes to bad habits or obvious weaknesses. Pre-commitment involves present planning and action against the strength of future desires, either by taking certain options off the table or making them prohibitively costly. Pre-commitment works and enables anyone to control their actions or face their own chosen penalty. So, an example, remember the old-style Christmas Club accounts. Pre-commitment, the current way of thinking about payroll deductions or setting up an automatic deduction from your checking account to go into your retirement account by planning to pay yourself first. A pre-commitment. So let's look then at commitment devices. Now, as we think about being an accountability partner in coaching, commitment devices may be a consideration. There have been studies on how people self-impose as well as co-create commitments for behavior that they know are in their best interest. And think about how we help our children do this. A piggy bank is a commitment device. Other ways that people counter their own vulnerability and bolster commitment to a better response. Some alcoholics take antabuse, a pill that makes you sick if you drink. Others do gastric bypass surgery. In one study, college students were given the option to create their own earlier deadlines for 3 papers due by the end of the semester. 75% of them jumped at the chance. Now think about that for a minute. 100% of them could have created this option on their own at any time or any timetable they decided. They could have created the option to set a deadline for their papers. But they responded, 75% of them did, to one that the authority offered. Another, and this is a response I had to one of my blogs, someone says she froze her credit card in ice. There was no impulse of spending. She had patiently waited 18 hours. I mean, a huge block of ice, not just like an ice cube, but I mean a huge block of ice. People find ways of saving themselves from immediate craving. A study of Harvard Business School looked at the ways people dealt with purchasing want products and should products. They would devise ways to either put off purchasing or to put off receiving delivery on the want products to ensure that they would do what they needed to do first. Now, based on the Harvard Business School study, corporations may be helping us bring about our better selves by packaging should and want items in unique ways. There's an article not too long ago in Newsweek about that. We can collaborate with clients to construct commitment devices to do what's in their best interest. For example, prioritize shoulds and reward with wants. This reframes getting a want as part of a performance ethic. This contingency can remove guilt from what you both know you're going to do anyhow and planning a different scenario than impulsivity. Now, I want to review, and this is in your outline, the most frequent mistakes that I see made in writing a new story. One is not knowing that you don't know. How can people know that they don't know something? We believe we know, which blinds us to our ignorance, and may circumvent inquiry and exploration. This, in turn, causes us to be blind to signs that we may be mistaken. To know to ask is half the answer. 2, stopping at the first right answer. When we're solving problems or writing a new story, we may stop at the first reasonable action. Now, this can be a correct strategy, but it may stop us from considering other right answers, other correct strategies that could be even more effective. So we ask ourselves then for both of these first two, and then what? What else? Now, I want to introduce number three with a brief quiz. Five frogs sat on a log. They all considered their options. Four, however, planned their strategy and then decided they'd jump off. How many were left on the log? Well, five were left because they only planned and decided. They didn't commit to act. Number three is procrastination. Now, I'm talking about some of the broad themes here, the big patterns. Putting off an exercise program. Not paying yourself first. Not saving for contingencies. Not saving for retirement. Taking care of others but not yourself. Most of us live our lives as though there were an unlimited amount of time left. We have little sense of urgency, contributing to a lack of focus. Now, that doesn't mean that we acknowledge in an abstract way about the finiteness of life, but I'm talking about really practically. When the 2-minute warning sounds in football, teams sometimes achieve more in the final 2 minutes than they did in the previous 28. That does not apply to the Texans, by the way. This imminent deadline, a limited, finite amount of time to accomplish goals, focuses concentration and increases efforts. In our lives, we only rarely have a 2-minute warning. We play as if the notion of finite time is there, but maybe only an abstraction, something we acknowledge but seem not to internalize. Life is finite. It's just that the game clock is invisible. Four, inefficient energy management. Managing energy is a key to success. This begins with knowing your strengths, limitations, biological cycles, when you perform best, knowing what you do uniquely well, better than anyone else. So know how to enter and exit various states of mind, which works best for a particular task. I've given an example for writing and editing. Two different states of mind, two different parts of the brain, to be done at different times, not combined. Cluster activities that require the same state of mind. Identify what enhances your energy, anticipation, creativity, pleasure, meditation, prayer, collaboration. Identify what depletes your energy, toxic people or situations, negative mindset, lack of focus, too big and too global a focus. Five, ambiguity. If you're unclear about what options are available and don't know what it would be like to pursue them, since you haven't done it before, this uncertainty adds to decision paralysis. So at times, what looks like resistance can be simply a lack of clarity about what's next. People are more likely to change when new behavior is crystal clear, not vague or absent. Eat a healthier diet or save for the future are both vague and abstract. When you want to affect change in others, help them specifically script behaviors. When you want to enhance active decision-making, help them delimit and specify clear options. Change always has to begin at the level of individual decisions and specific behaviors. Six, too many choices.
Dr. Krueger, I have a question.
Yes, absolutely.
When you're dealing with people, giving them options, and you said sometimes we stop too soon, where do we know that we've given too many options and they need to make a decision?
We want to elicit the options from them, ideally. If they need the pump primed or if they need us to brainstorm, we'll do that. But the initiation should come from them in developing their story instead of giving them options as if it's multiple choice. So that's a basic assumption about helping someone to write their story. If you feel that they and you have really pursued the possibilities and you can feel it, you'll know in your gut when it's time to move and someone doesn't, when they're delaying or procrastinating, and you begin to feel a little bit of impatience or let's just get on with it or let's go ahead already, you'll know when you may need to nudge someone or simply to ask in a collaborative way. How will you know when you've done enough research and have enough information to make a decision? And
I'll listen.
Say again?
I find this more prevalent in perfectionists.
Yes. And you know, the a perfectionist will do ready, aim, and not fire. And we may have to know someone to do ready, fire, aim. And that doesn't mean to go out half-cocked, but you have to proceed and then self-correct. And you'll see the value of doing that, because to seek perfection is to not have a goal, because you're never perfect. So it's a way of putting off something. So this is where we need to know somebody and be a catalyst for challenging somebody if you see that. So you're very right. I think there are times we have to challenge somebody about how will you know and when will it be time. And if they can answer that for themselves and it's reasonable, then we're holding them accountable for that. And we'll both know when it's time. Because, you know, it's a matter of dosing and timing and time grading, but it's also a matter of doing and self-correcting. So that, this is it's a great question, and it's a very useful juncture that there's no preset answer for, but a perfectionist, by definition, has no endpoint because they'll never get there. So they'll never be ready if perfect is there. Just like more is not a goal. You know, well, I want more money. You never get there, so it's endless. So perfect and more are not endpoints. So those, I think, deserve to be challenged.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So six is too many choices. Studies have shown how an HR department or individual investment advisor can provide too many choices and extra options can backfire, leading to decision paralysis. Every time you add other options, the employee's rate of participation in a retirement fund goes down by 2%. You can offer too many possibilities, and the more possibilities that are offered, the person goes in the opposite direction of not choosing. So at some point, choice debilitates rather than liberates, so someone retreats to the default decision of not making a choice. You've probably had this experience before. You just come across so much stuff, it looks so overwhelming. I used to do that in, I think I mentioned this, in college. I'd go to the academic center, I'd have all this massive stuff that I needed to study, and I'd look at it and promptly take a nap. Now, a classic study in decision paralysis was done at a gourmet grocery store. You probably heard about this. The research project offered a display of 6 jams for tasting. Now, on an alternate weekend, there were 24 jams available for tasting. For both of the weekends, the customers were given a coupon for $1 off if they purchased any jam. While the larger display of jams attracted more potential customers, in both cases, people sampled an equal number of jams. When 24 varieties were available for tasting, 3% of the people purchased. When 6 varieties were available for tasting, 30% purchased. Too many choices resulted in a tenfold decline of actual purchases. With too many choices, we feel overwhelmed and resort to our comfort zone to do nothing or to take a nap. 7, lack of persistence. The truly challenging, courageous part of change is not the initial decision or the initiation of a new order of things. It's the willingness to stay the course. A clearly defined goal can capture imagination and inspire passion. It can cut through the fog like a beacon of light. One extra degree of effort in business and life, can separate the good from the great. 51 publishers turned down Richard Bach to publish Jonathan Livingston Seagull. He took it to number 52. 141 publishers turned down a guy who decided then to publish his book himself and sell it out of the back of his car. It had a really unlikely, kind of goofy title for a book, Chicken Soup for the Soul. He's since published $1.5 billion of value in books. To get what you've never had, you probably have to do what you've never done. And Lord Eliot put it very simply, perseverance is not a long race. It's many short races, one after another. 8, not following success trails. Decide how you want to expand, then pick success trails to follow. When my good buddy Art heard that I was, he's the one, Art Wilson, who I do the What's Next exec retreats with now. When he heard I was transitioning from psychoanalytic practice and completed my professional coach certification, he flew to Houston to take me to dinner. Several years earlier, he had left a very early retirement from IBM as a senior executive and formed his own consultation company. And he was already immensely successful. He told me how he chose five very successful people, asked them for lunch or dinner to pick their brains about what he was about to do, people who had done something similar to him. He advised me to do the same. It worked for both of us. Some business people with instant global recognition picked his brain for substantial picking fees. So create a support team, construct an advisory board, a networking group, engage a mentor, even a mentor for a single session about a tough case. I have a number of people who call and say, Dave, I need to buy an hour of your time. I have a really tough case I want to talk about. Join a mastermind group. Let's talk about adaptation success. This is one of the things that I think is really, really important, and one thing that you'll see in coaching again and again. Success is never final. Don't get complacent. Testing is as important as postulating. Test ideas out, revise them, make it your story, told with your voice. One reason to be very clear about your needs and ideals, and to have a clear idea of your story, is to deal with success. I think it's more challenging to deal with massive success than it is with adversity or scarcity. And my prediction, each of you will have a new level of success that you haven't had before. So I want you to be ready for it and take it in stride. The writer, F. Scott Fitzgerald, had just completed his novel, This Side of Paradise. He was riding high, a hugely successful writer in every aspect. He just married a beautiful wife, had a storybook life. Then Fitzgerald said, riding in a taxi one afternoon between very tall buildings in New York City, I began to bawl. I had everything I wanted, and I knew I would never be so happy again. The problem, he felt, was that every story must end. And being an author, that's what it had been for him. He then descended into depression and alcoholism and died a very early death. Elvis became the story of success, but that was not the story that brought him to success. But he identified with the success story and lost himself in it. His true story ended when he lay cold on the bathroom floor at age 42, full of drugs and the trappings of success. Two guys who needed mentor coaching not to become successful, but to deal with success. Failure and success are both stories, external stories about events, meaning that you have to continue with efforts and change to sustain success. Either story, failure or success, can change. It can continue, grow, or end. To continue with success stories, to continue doing that which created the success. After you arrive at the success, you can't stop doing the things that created it and just inhabit it. The things having to do with success itself and the enjoyment. Soon then, success will wither and the story change. You can become defined by the story. And again, let me repeat this from the Your New Money Story discussion. It's not wealth, position, possessions, or even the chase of happiness that creates problems. It's when you lose yourself in the story of the chase. Now, another aspect of adaptation to success is to occasionally bring to the foreground and reexamine why you got up in the morning. What is your challenge, your satisfaction, your creative effort and pleasure, your passion, your achievement? And as Aaron was asking and discussing, remember that immobilization and distress can be created by prolonged planning, the ready, aim versus ready, fire, aim. Continuing to align yourself with the universe. Ultimately, very mellow can be compromised by very poor. Also, wish boards and repeating daily affirmations without taking action. Remember my grandmother, the secret critic, 5 decades before the book came out. Her version, wishes don't wash dishes. So common to each of these is a need for a plan to be coupled with action. Now, I want to examine a concept that we've looked at just to see how far we've come, creating a new belief. how we tell our stories of the past will shape our future. Some stories get told so much or so often that they achieve the status of becoming a personal myth. If I were little loved enough, if I just had enough money. When you're ready to write a new belief, focus on it frequently and return to it often and in every way you can. The new belief has to replace the old belief. Create a vision of yourself getting the results from the new belief. And this is a story about how belief can determine an outcome. Nathan Handworker, now you know this better be a good story than anything like that. Nathan Handworker put in a new food stand in 1916 in Coney Island. Handworker's hot dogs were pure beef made from his wife's recipe, every bit as delicious as his competitors. But he priced his at 5 cents, and the other hot dogs were priced at 10 cents. He attracted no customers. People wondered if his hot dogs were inferior. They attributed poor quality ingredients to his product. His sales were not increased when he offered free root beer and free pickles. That just furthered the notion that his value must be substandard because he was giving away additional stuff trying to, you know, hawk his hot dog. Then Handworker came up with an employee. He did two things. He asked doctors from a nearby hospital to stand around eating his hot dogs while they were wearing their white coats and stethoscopes. He kind of introduced the idea of testimonials. And he raised his prices. They began selling well. People assumed that a physician were eating his food and that it was priced at least as much and more than some. It had to be good. They became a national phenomenon. Nathan's famous hot dogs, they're still around today. The value we attribute, the belief, can fundamentally change how we perceive something. Creating a new belief is not an instantaneous thing. It's a process. It can take a period of time. Or, this process of believing and changing belief is just that, a process, not an event. It can be planned, though, step by step with incremental progress. And it takes however long it takes. It's your process, not anyone else's. Don't compare your inside to somebody else's outside. Don't compare your journey, your timetable, your progress with anyone else's. It's uniquely yours, your story. However long it takes, you can make it worth it. So in changing your belief and the result of the change in your action, you're also changing your mind as well as your brain. At any moment in time, neural networks are influenced by three factors: genes, experiences, and focused attention. Regardless of someone's unique brain architecture and individual complexity, these three factors intersect at any moment, at any nanosecond. DNA downloads information from expression of its code. We now know it goes in the other direction as well. Our experiences, our beliefs, can actually turn genes on or turn them off to determine the major extent of the expression of much of DNA-based information. Dr. Bruce Lipton, I've heard him in person say this, summarized his findings, emphasizing that genes can't turn themselves on or off, but adapt to, among many other things, beliefs and experiences. Now, one last note on beliefs and the attribution of value. On a January morning in 2007 during rush hour, an ordinary-looking guy dressed in blue jeans and a baseball cap took out his violin on a subway station in Washington, D.C. For the next 43 minutes, he performed one of the most challenging pieces composed for the violin, Bach sonatas and partitas for unaccompanied violin. 1,097 people walked by. He was barely noticed, just playing on a passenger platform like an average street performer. In fact, I've seen the video. Only one person stopped and really recognized him. His name, Joshua Bell, one of the greatest violinists alive, who regularly performs to sold-out crowds at concert halls throughout the world. His violin, a $3.5 million Stradivarius. In this study by the Washington Post, the D.C. commuters heard a world-class concert, but the value they attributed to Bell's performance was based on their perception. Value attribution is our own shortcut to determine how we judge what we see, even what's worthy of our attention. Then, the value we assign shapes our perception. We heard in Ahalia's case study how she is valuing her contribution and offering and benefit in a much greater way. I suspect that she's closer and closer to charging what she's worth. So, now, just in a very brief overview, one way to think about this is to look at the correct paradigm. And the correct paradigm for a story, I think, is really important. Let me give you an example of one way of framing this. One night on a camping trip, Sherlock Holmes wakes up Watson and says, "Look at the stars. What do you deduce?" Watson thinks for a minute and says, "Well, I see millions of stars, many of which resemble our sun, which most likely have their own planets, which most likely have life forms like us. So I deduce that there is life on other planets." And Sherlock said, "No, you idiot. Somebody's stolen our tent." Now, consider each of these paradigms as we look at things and encourage and nudge our clients to look at things in different ways. Genetic determinism. Your genes are doing it to you. It's an inherited trait fashioned by long-standing DNA copy. If you're Irish, that adds to your temper. Psychic determinism. Your parents did it to you. Environmental determinism. Your boss or your spouse or the economy is doing it to you. The antithesis of each of these paradigms of determinism is mastery within our own system of authority. And consider this. Whatever remains unconscious will emerge later as fate. Now, I want to look at, in conclusion, I want to look at the last stages of success and do a final exercise with you. So, this is to move beyond the wide-angle lens that we use at times to now look at time-lapse photography about life stages of success, because success may mean different things at different points in adult life, even at each developmental phase. So I want to summarize this, and there is a quote I'm going to use for each that summarizes it in the most elegant way, more than I could with many times as many words. Here's how it can look in a relationship, and this is from Ruby Dee in I Dream a World. It takes a long time to be really married. One marries many times at many levels in a marriage. If you have more marriages than divorces within the marriage, you're lucky and you stick it out. Here's one way of looking at individual success. This is from Wolfgang von Goethe. Whoever in middle age attempts to realize the wishes and hopes of his early youth invariably deceives himself. Each 10 years of a person's life has its own fortunes, its own hopes, its own desires. And that's important because if we hear a client trying to catch up with what was missed in the last decade, they're going to miss some of this decade. So the way to help them resolve that is to help them mourn it, to say goodbye to it so they can fully engage the present. Dreams change. We realize some, we relinquish some, we create some new ones. Growth is flexible and dynamic. Once you achieve monetary success and professional prestige, you can then figure out what's really important. Of course, the secret is, ideally, before, and you'll achieve even more prestige and more success. A caveat, be sure success doesn't constrict you from doing what you really want to do, but frees you to do what you really want to do. And here's that time-lapse photo from a different perspective, from my favorite essayist, Emerson. Not in his goals, but in his transitions, man is great. I want to do a final exercise with you. I would like you to find a way to get totally comfortable in your chair and close your eyes. If you put your phone where it's held in your between your chin and your shoulder so that you can be totally free and totally relaxed. Be aware of how completely, comfortably, and fully your chair is holding you. Take a deep breath in, breathing in relaxation, breathing out any tension. One more deep breath in of relaxation, another out. I'd like you to close your eyes. Imagine you're 90 years old. Look back at yourself now. look at how things will turn out on your present trajectory. How would they turn out on a different path? Does the difference between the two suggest a change or a transition? What kind? Be specific. From 90 looking back, what do you see that you might have really seen right now but didn't acknowledge? What do you feel about your situation now? What do you want to tell yourself now? For example, any turns or cautions or risk that you should or shouldn't have taken. Keep your eyes closed and look carefully at your 90-year-old eyes, your face, your hands, your 90-year-old body. Look around at where you are. And at who's there with you. Remember, you always know more than you think. Thoughts? He's back into being focused on our seminar. It may take a moment. Was that a meaningful exercise for you?